Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And happy Halloween to you. I'm going to finish out this Monster Professor podcast October takeover with one more. I said about an episode a week, and we got five in a month of 4 weeks, because that's how cool October is. And if you haven't already rated or subscribed to the show through whichever medium you listen to it on, or spread the word, I appreciate it. It'll help me out. Today's conversation is with Fred Venturini, and he's a novelist among other things, but he's also an expert on slasher films, and he knows this stuff, so I wanted to pick his mind specifically about the slasher. Now, a little bit about Fred. He has 11 scars from 11 separate incidents. One of the most interesting was the time he was set on fire, not unlike the main character in his book that you'll hear us discuss. For the other scars, just ask him. His short fiction, he's been on All Over the Place Booked Anthology, Noir at the Bar, Chuck Palahniuk's Burnt Tongues Anthology. His novels, though, are The Heart Does Not Grow Back and the just now released Escape of Light. And like I said, we're going to get into what makes the slasher film what it is, and where does its strange kind of magic come from? I hope you enjoy our answers to this and the conversation itself. So here we go with Fred Venturini. Okay, well, first of all, thank you so much for finally coming on the podcast, Fred Venturini. I've been trying to get you on here for a while, for a couple of reasons. One, I think you've seen every slasher film ever made, and so you're the closest to a slasher film expert that I know. And second of all, you've got a new book that has just dropped, The Escape of Light, which is, although a different genre from slasher, is fantastic. So maybe we'll start a little bit, let everybody know a little bit about this new book that's dropping, and then let's get into slasher films. So thanks for coming on the podcast, and tell me about Escape of Light, if you would.
Yeah, well, first of all, I appreciate the invitation, and you know, you said I kind of watched everyone when you mentioned you wanted to do this. As you well know, one of the things that delayed me is I kind of wanted to rewatch every one of them. So it's been an entertaining year for that. And yeah, the new book came out Tuesday. And what's nuts is we're going to talk about all these slasher things, but it's kind of an inspirational, motivational, coming of age, young adult novel about a burn survivor going to high school and kind of going through tragedy and the big game and the big dance and trying to get the girl and all that stuff. But I think there's demographic crossover. I think the type of person who likes young adult fiction in today's book landscape is still the type of person who enjoys horror movies and slasher movies. And I remember saying, what is YA? You know, because we were talking about positioning this new book as young adult. And what's nuts is, you know, agents, editors, they really don't have a definition. It's like the one thing that stood out, young people are fascinated with death, which I think really speaks to the revival of horror, the popularity of horror in general. And then when you look back at kind of the inherent darkness of something like Hunger Games and Twilight and all those kind of post-apocalyptic young adult novels, now we're into kind of the realism young adult novels like The Fault in Our Stars. And this one's about a burn survivor. I like to think of it as an old, you know, the movie and book Wonder. It's kind of an older Wonder. Yeah. So that's where the book is coming from. But, you know, like every other 39-year-old novelist out there, I grew up with Stephen King. I got the dark side to me. This is a light side book, and I think we're talking about the dark side here today. So I appreciate being on to kind of exercise the demons a little bit, because the last year has been, you know, young adult, motivational, inspirational Fred Venturini, as you well know. I like to skirt the other side of the spectrum there.
Yeah, you definitely have a dark side, especially if anybody knows about your earlier stuff. Well, you know, you had a nice balance. The Heart Does Not Grow Back is the first major novel that we know from you, but we've also you were involved with Chuck Palahniuk's stuff, such as his Burnt Tongues anthology, and yours, and even in Surreal South, you were in there. So you've got some dark and brutal stuff when you want to get into it, man.
Yeah. Well, I'm starting to think, what is the brand? How would an audience for this book enjoy my return to darkness and my plans for a slasher novel respond to that? And you know what editors and agents tend to say is, well, you take a genre and you always seem to do something interesting with it. So if I did, you know, if you call The Heart Does Not Grow Back a really weird, dark superhero take, which Joker just came out, and I'm like, if that works as a film, that's like, my book should work as a film, because it's a very dark, weird superhero take, you know? And this one's a young adult take that kind of does something different with the genre. For one thing, you don't see happy endings in YA novels, and I try to at least have I tried to stick the landing there, and I still tried to bring, I don't know, an edgy voice to it. And so that seems to be the brand that I'm doing that allows me to kind of do the kinds of books that I want to do. I don't want to get stacked up as a YA author or a horror author or a transgressive author or any of that. I just want to, hey, that's a good idea. Let's work on that. So.
Yeah, I think your style, mixes that up quite well. It's like your book could beat up John Green's books. like it's maybe in the same arena, but yours is a bit tougher, I think. Something well, along those lines.
If my books beat up his books, I hope they take his lunch money. Because there's a guy who's got plenty of it.
I don't know if the pockets are big enough in anybody's pants to take his money. So maybe we should just jump right into slashers, because this is Halloween time. I think if you're listening to this as it releases, it's about the day of Halloween. And so what better thing to jump into than slasher films? I know some of them, and I have some ideas, but I think I have more questions than answers, and I think you're my man for answers. So, like, maybe we could start with, what are your thoughts on what makes the slasher film, and what makes the slasher film different from, say, another type of film with a killer in it, like, I don't know, Silence of the Lambs or something, versus, you know, Friday the 13th? Like, so what makes a slasher film?
So, yeah, you know, and here's the thing. I'm a self-proclaimed slasher expert only because I grew up with them, I've watched them, and I tend to have interesting discussions about them, and I really am kind of a purist. So you mentioned Silence of the Lambs, which I'll probably mention later when we talk maybe about Point of View. Definitely not a slasher. You know, these home invasion movies like The Strangers, definitely not a slasher. What it really needs is a body count. It needs to be fast, brutal, quick kills. There needs to be a body count. There's usually a very compressed setting, a remote setting. All of the horror tropes that we seem to know about kind of derive from the slasher, the cabin in the woods kind of thing, the, oh, it's just a cat, false jump scares. And then, of course, your psycho killer, who usually is silent, is unstoppable, is almost a primal evil, an embodiment of death itself, which is why there is no torturing these victims. It's almost like real death is just sudden, unpredictable, and, you know, having a sudden heart attack is not very much different than running into Jason Voorhees in the woods. And then the character archetypes. You have a cast, and we know all the tropes. Okay, they're all dead. Here's our final girl candidates, right? So, and the reason these tropes are so ingrained is because the slasher genre kind of encompassed the entire horror genre in the late 70s and 80s. What did I say? One setting? Yeah. That means it's cheap to make. You don't need name actors. You need no names who are going to take their clothes off and just get killed or have one or two scenes. So sometimes you strike gold, like the final chapter, you know, Friday the 13th, the final chapter, Crispin Glover as a side character. I mean, you strike gold with that, right? So that generally to me is that lumbering psycho killer that's almost unstoppable, body count, fast, brutal kills. And you got to check off a few of the boxes. You know, even if you're going to play against the tropes, they've got to be in there. You know, you don't see a slasher film taking place on the streets of New York, which I think is a really amazing idea that they tried to do with Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, well, I remember this god-awful scene of, like, Jason, like, getting, like, in a boxing match on a rooftop in New
York
City.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And he takes a licking, and he one punch, and he blows the guy's head clean off. There's also, you know, you can play it for comedy. There's also some, you know, funniness to these and some brevity. Like when the gangbangers in Manhattan are going to cut him up and they're pulling out their butterfly knives. And all he does is lift his hockey mask and they run away. I mean, that's great. But that movie is a famous lost opportunity because they just didn't have the budget. They ended up filming it all on the ship that goes to Manhattan. So you get 90% of the running time on the Love Boat. And 10% of the running time is he arrives in Manhattan, has one or two cool scenes, and then just kind of a really crappy ending, so to speak. So, yeah. But long meandering answer, that's the slasher.
Now, I have this notion that, you'll have to correct me on the origin. Like, where did this thing really get going? Well, let me hit you with a bunch of questions at first, and see if we can piece them out. Cause I want to know, like, where this came from. What are the origins? I want to know, like, why we love them so much, or if they mean something, like, what do they mean? And maybe they don't. It's just that we love them. And then I want to spend a little bit of time, if we could, like, piecing apart the killer in the slasher as a,
right,
as a monster. So maybe we should start with the origins. I happen to, when I finally discovered pretty recently John Carpenter's original Halloween movie, I was just blown away at how sweet and atmospheric it was. It was just, like, so wonderfully, it's so pleasant. It makes me feel happy. It's not like the thing that I had always heard it was. I didn't watch it for the first time till, like, 5 or 6 years ago. I expected it to be the kind of 80s slasher that I knew of, but it wasn't. It was just, like, hanging out in a small town with a whole bunch of tension, and then every now and then there would be kind of an artful murder.
But I don't probably less blood than you think, probably less Michael Myers than you think. Very cheaply done. You know, just a couple of piano notes and just a couple small town sets and some no-name actors. And hey, let's the mask is famously a William Shatner mask turned inside out. and so the Shatner's face is basically Michael Myers, and it's quintessential John Carpenter bootstrappery. And to me, that is the tipping point. That is the artful slasher. You know, it's not the granddaddy of them all, but it was kind of it perfected the formula and kind of unleashed this tidal wave of slashers from 1978 all the way up through the 80s. There's almost too many to count. And like I said, it encompasses almost the entire horror genre of, you know, your VHS trips in the late 70s and 1980s. And I was one of those kids going and stacking up all these crazy horror movies with these crazy covers, and they were all slasher movies, every single one of them. So I think that's the tipping point. Now, if you're asking about origins, I did a deep dive into what I always thought, and I still think, 1974's Black Christmas is the first kind of pure slasher, the one that really kind of meets the definition. So, you know, you're watching it again. It's not my favorite. It's kind of slow moving, but all of the staples are there. The point of view shots from the killer, the nihilistic type ending. It never explained the killer's motivations. He's just there to kill one after the other. Compressed setting of a sorority house. The calls coming from inside the house kind of trope is there. So to me, that's the first slasher, and it's closely related to Halloween because Bob Clark is the director of Black Christmas, who's also the director of A Christmas Story, which is a fun little
kidding.
Yeah. So the guy who directed A Christmas Story, which is going to run 24/7 for the next few months, also directed and created Black Christmas, and kind of maybe not invented, but started to perfect the monster of the slasher genre, and had a conversation with John Carpenter, who says, I love Black Christmas. Are you going to make another one? And he goes, I have an idea, where the psycho goes back to his hometown on a totally different holiday, and I'm going to call it Halloween, and he's going to keep the holiday theme. So John Carpenter, of course, a few years later, what happens? He makes Halloween. And I know there's some Bob Clark quotes out there saying, look, an idea – and this is true, and more people should be like this. An idea is not a movie. It was a quick conversation with John. He made it. You know, go with God. He really has no how can I say – ill will or anything. There's no, oh, he stole my idea or anything like that. In 4 years between movies, obviously there was plenty of opportunity to kind of do his own Bob Clark take on Halloween.
Yeah.
But that's why I think that Black Christmas is probably the tipping point for the beginning of the subgenre. Now, before that, there was a great, I think I told you about this, a great Joe Bob Briggs deep dive on something called Blood Feast, which is maybe the first gore movie. And it's kind of slasher-y. It's got one person killing again and again for a ritual sacrifice, and there's a lot of gore, and it's a very old movie, but I don't think it's a pure slasher. You know, the guy's a character, you know his motivations. It's more, I think, giallo than slasher, and that's another one. The best slasher movies of all time has a bunch of Italian giallo movies on them. To me, that's its own subgenre. You know, black love, point of view shots, the bright colors, all that stuff. To me, they're not slashers. So I draw the line there.
What about Psycho? Like, some people have told me Psycho's the first slasher, and just never felt like a slasher to me, although there's a slashing, and famous slashing in it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, what's your take on Psycho, on Alfred Hitchcock?
Psycho's not a slasher. It's not a pure slasher movie by the definition of the subgenre, because the main character is Norman Bates, and you know why he's killing. And look, it's a great movie. It's a scary movie. It's a dramatic movie. It's a seminal movie. But if it was a slasher, we wouldn't know much about Norman other than the fact that he's showing up every 10 minutes or so. And that's usually the average. Every 10 minutes, there has to be a kill. That's the formula to kill somebody quickly for no reason. You know, it's like, but we know his motivations. We know that he's psycho. And he's way too much part of the movie for it to be a slash movie.
Yeah. So with that beginning of Halloween, man, Halloween was just so good. I can't get it out of my head. Like, he made that off of no money whatsoever. You get this sense that you're in this fictional town in Illinois, Haddonfield, Illinois. It feels like fall, even though he was shooting this thing in the middle of like summer in California when they were just blowing leaves around and gathering them back up. And you think, well, they're really just a bunch of like film, like not a bunch, just a few film students, like each one doing 20 jobs. Like, how in the world did they get Donald Pleasance, who did a fantastic job? And I remember some interview saying, he said the only reason he did it is because his daughter forced him to, because she loved John Carpenter's soundtrack and Assault on Precinct 13. Yeah, that's what it was. And so he kind of got just pressured into it by his daughter. And so this magical thing happened, but then you're right, man, it just blew up. And so from there, after Halloween, the Michael Myers, what would be the kind of the iconic slashers you'd name from there? We talked Friday the 13th, Jason. What else would you have in mind?
So, you know, you have your the unholy trinity that everybody recognizes. You know, you got Michael Myers, you got Jason Voorhees, you got Freddy Krueger, right? There's your Mount Rushmore. and to me, there is no fourth spot. You know, it's those three. Someone like to, oh, Leatherface is like, and that, no, not the same. So, you know, there's your first three. Then you kind of have your second team of slashers, and you can throw guys like, you know, Chucky from the Chucky movies in there, or Candyman, and you know, the Hook guy from I Know What You Did Last Summer, or Ghostface from the Scream movies, right? But it's those three, and you have Halloween in 78, and then you have the original Friday the 13th. And I think 1980, and then Friday the 13th Part 2, which to me is, you know, everybody, oh, the original. No, part two has Jason. It's a very human Jason. It's a very grounded and scary movie. And so the way I kind of break it up is I look at foundations, right? And I think you saw some of the capsules that I shared with you. You know, you have your foundational movies like Black Christmas and Halloween, and to some extent, Texas Chainsaw, and then your Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th Part 2. Then I have a whole subset of kind of the peaks that they kind of laid this foundation to then have, I don't know, the highest and best realization of the characters, if that makes sense, in some of the later best sequels. You couldn't have the best at first. You kind of have to lay a foundation and have the best ones later.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you're bringing up Leatherface and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that was, I mean, that was really cool, but that, as you're pointing, that's not, as you're pointing out, that's not entirely slasher. It's a little bit different. Like, they get, like, stuck and kidnapped, and there's some amazing scenes, but it doesn't feel quite the same as that, like, killer coming into the safer or ordinary world as you get in the others.
The reason I count it, and I think it's very foundational, is because of the time. I think it came out in 76.
Yeah.
So it's right after Black Christmas. You have Texas Chainsaw comes out, and it kind of checks a lot of the boxes. You know, Leatherface and his family there, you know, you're not sitting there getting any sort of origin story, fast, brutal kills that are spaced out. You know, it's still an isolated area. Instead of the killer coming to the house or the campgrounds or Springwood, they kind of stumble into this hellhole and become stalked by this serial madman. So I think it's very influential. And while it's not a tight rendering of the formula, well, there was no formula when that came out.
Yeah.
So people would watch that and be influenced by it and look at a Leatherface and make that part of the formula. So I think it's very influential in that way. So, you know, I think it barely qualifies as a pure formulaic slasher movie. So I put it in the box. But I think because of the cultural impact, I don't think Leatherface is as iconic as the other three, you know, the unholy trinity that everybody's seen on these movie marathons. So, and there's another one just like the John Carpenter one. It's a bunch of film students doing something very cheap, and kind of hitting pay dirt with it.
Yeah. And each one of these, it seems like, well, from Michael Myers, Leatherface, Jason, and then even kind of Freddy and Chucky and Ghostface from Scream, there seems to be something about the face and the mask and covering the face. And even with, like you say, Freddy Krueger doesn't have a mask, but his face is still covered and just all these scars and stuff. It's like you can't really recognize. So, and Chucky's, well, that is a doll mask for a face. It just also happens to be his head. So what's up with that? What's up with the covering of the face or the mask face? Why do we do that?
So from a functional perspective, I just feel like from the filmmaker's perspective is it's scarier and it's cheap, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. You don't have to do any kind of, you know, like Friday the 13th Part 2, you don't have to do all this makeup to make Jason look like the drowning victim from Part 1. You just throw a bag on his head. So, you know, once again, instead of having a person, throw the William Shatner mask on him. Make it white, right? So that to me is the functional aspect of it. But one of the reasons that I think it's become this trend and it kind of resonates is death comes in many forms. And, you know, we always give death these, you know, that never shows up kind of as a person. It's like a grim reaper or a skeleton or a white face. And you kind of want to feel like in these movies that something not human is after them, even though it's technically a human, even though it's kind of supernaturally powered. And, the other thing about a mask is it creates mystery. We don't know the identity. We don't know what they really look like. Whenever you have these scenes in some of these movies where Michael Myers lifts his mask, right? Or Jason lifts his mask, or you see his face, they become big moments. And you can set those moments up dramatically by concealing that information. And you only do that with a mask. So.
And that further emphasizes that point you're making, like these killers end up being this kind of the real embodiment of death. It's not the same as like the sadistic torturer or the inquisitor or something like that. It's death pops up and you're done and that's it. And there's no getting away from it. It pursues you. So I'm thinking like, well, what's the oldest version of the slasher I can think of? Maybe the angel of death in Exodus, where he's coming for the firstborn children. I mean, he's walking through the neighborhood and if you don't have the lamb's blood on your door, he's going to walk in and slash your kids up. I don't know.
Let me sit here and do some math. I think that checks out, because the other thing that's almost become a cliche in slasher movies and going back to Exodus is punishment for sin. Usually the kids that get killed first, you know, the whole trope of the final girl is a virgin. Everybody else is drinking, having sex, going crazy, and they're getting chopped down one by one.
Yeah.
But her snow white purity allows her to survive, even though it really has nothing to do with it. It's a random thing.
And I remember John Carpenter being asked about that in some interview, and he was trying to deny it, but there's just no, maybe he wants to, sure he can deny it. I think he said something like, they weren't being killed for their fornication and she wasn't saved for purity. It was just the revenge of the sexually oppressed. Like they were both, like Jason wasn't, or Michael Myers was repressed sexually and wanted to lash out at people or whatever. I don't think any of that checks out. I think he was just trying to avoid the deep morality of it.
I think that we are assigning meaning and reasons when you're talking about a band of filmmakers doing stuff fast and cheap. And you know, if you have a couple of teenagers sitting there watching TV, how are you gonna make them vulnerable? What are they gonna talk about? What kind of scene are you gonna have? Well, the default is, he's probably gonna. It's 1980s. You're out there trying to get laid in the woods.
Yeah.
So that becomes what the conversation is about, and it makes you very vulnerable in that moment, and it makes you. It's just an easy way to unfold those scenes in a dramatic way. Would you rather have them talk about the stock market? So, you know, and I think we do this now. We see these tropes have emerged. We see the history laid out in the past, and we try to assign meaning to a lot of things that were just pretty darn random. And if you look at them from a functional perspective, the movies were popular because they were fast, cheap, and easy to make. A lot of filmmakers got started with them. And they were making these decisions based on that. They're not sitting there with a philosophy book trying to say anything about the larger world. We have AV clubbed that into it. So,
yeah, you're right. And we got to see a pretty coherent tradition emerge in just a handful of decades in an art form, which maybe leads me to this other question. I have a feeling I already know what your answer is to it, but I'm going to throw this one at you anyway. Speaking of like this tradition and this art form that has emerged, do we have any slasher novels? Can the slasher exist in book form? What do you say?
You know, I didn't look hard. I've never really read what I perceive to be a slasher novel. And I looked around in preparation for writing this article or talking on this podcast. And I did go through Silence of the Lambs again. And I've come to this conclusion that one of the things that makes the slasher a purely cinematic experience, almost a pure expression of cinema, is that you can do things in a slasher movie that you almost can't do in a book without breaking it. And it's kind of crazy that the reverse is usually true. The book is always better because you can do more than you can with filmmaking. And with the slashers, I think the inverse is true. A couple of quick examples. One is, you know, just looking back at the Thomas Harris book, Silence of the Lambs. One of the most famous scenes is Clarice is alone in the dark. He's got night vision goggles on.
Yeah.
She does not. She is blind. That is a terrifying scene in the movie, which won Best Picture. Everybody loves the movie, right? So you see this a lot in slasher movies. Somebody's in the kitchen chopping onions, or they're making out, or they're doing something. You, as the viewer, see the threat where they do not. You, as the viewer, see, oh my God, Michael Myers just walked behind her or sat up behind her. Or, oh my God, he's right around the corner. And it kind of creates that tension. You know the danger, the hero does not. Now, you can do that in a novel. You can build tension by setting a trap the hero doesn't know about. But you usually do it by switching point of view. You set it up from the villain's perspective in like one chapter, and then you have the hero kind of walking into it. And if you look at the Silence of the Lambs, the only way you can come close to kind of rendering that in real time is with an omniscient point of view. You kind of have to break away from Clarice's point of view to have a couple paragraphs with James Gum, who's like right behind her, right? So as I read this scene and the point of view kind of falls apart with it, and then you watch the scene as a film, you're like, wow, I think the movie version of that scene is better.
Yeah.
So it's the immediacy of it. And then here's another thing that you really, I can't think of a way that you can do it with a novel, and it's the use of the point of view shot. So what they set up in these slashers is sometimes you're looking through the eyes of the killer. Now, sometimes it's very obvious. Black Christmas has the breathing of the killer. You can see the killer's hands reach out. John Carpenter's Halloween, of course, you know, from the very beginning, you have a point of view shot through a mask. You see the eye holes and all this stuff. So sometimes it's very obvious. Wow, I'm looking through the eyes of the killer, which creates a different experience. Now, what I think is kind of unnovelable is some of these movies build up that, okay, we're looking through the eyes of the killer. And then you have these scenes where the camera's looking through the bushes in a very foreboding way at a potential victim. And you actually don't know if you're looking through the eyes of the killer, or, you know, is she in danger? Are you looking through the eyes of the killer, or are you safe? And is this just a regular shot to build tent? You don't know.
Yeah.
So that allows you to be jump scared. That allows you to be red herringed, and it allows you to sit there wondering, is she in danger or not? It builds tension in a completely unique way that I don't think you can have, oh shit, it's just a cat, pop out of a novel, you know, unless it's like a pop-up book that slaps you in the face.
Yeah. I mean, just the having to work with the medium of subjects and verbs within sentences, what are you going to put for the subject for the thing that you want them to think is the killer, but then is the cat? That's tough to do. That's tough to do. I mean, there are ways you can do that kind of suspense. Like I'm trying to think of something too. Like, I don't know, Dean Koontz's Intensity. It's kind of like that, but
right.
But it Once would again, fall apart if there's like one murder or something like that, and the whole thing is just build up in tension. It would have fallen apart had it actually been a slasher, a whole bunch of killers.
Yeah, and you think of that as a book. You know, there's the scene where she thinks that the cop is helping her, but he's the cop. Spoiler alert! But hey, it's been what 20 years or whatever. Way more than that, 25, 30. So anyway, you set that up because he switches. He alternates points of view between the killer who's pursuing her and her who is hiding, which is an interesting take, right? But it's a home invasion story that's artfully done. It's probably my favorite Koontz book. But it's not a slasher. There's no body count. You know what he's all about. You know his philosophy. You're in his head. Now, of course, that's interesting, and you can do that in a book better than you can a movie. But if you're looking for that pure slasher experience, an expression of pure cinema. I don't know if you can actually replicate that.
Yeah. So I like that. I like that. So that the slasher film, of all the things that we have in film, and film is this, you know, 20th, the art form that really came alive in the 20th century. I love this idea that the only genre of it that is purely cinema is the slasher, and that everything else is kind of rendered in novelized form, but not the slasher.
The other thing that makes, to me, slasher movies a pure expression of cinema is because you and I can grab our iPhones and go out in the woods with a couple of friends, and we can probably make a somewhat competent slasher movie. Like, yeah. it is one of the gateway drugs into making movies. And there are a lot of very prominent filmmakers who got started in horror in general.
Yeah.
And when you look at, my God, the video store would just overrun with these movies in the 80s. That's why, is because you could make them cheap. And they were profitable. You know, I was watching the documentary Crystal Lake Memories about the multitude of Jason Voorhees movies, the Friday the 13th movies. And I forget his name. I don't have my notes or anything. But I can give you the gist of the quote. And the quote is, they're asking about, you know, this legacy And he would say, you know what? The movie would come out on a Friday, and on Monday, Paramount would call and say, go make another one. And I remember him saying, these decisions were purely transactional. We were not making high art. And every time you look at the bumpy start to the series, every time Friday the 13th tried to do something interesting, right? Like killing Jason off for good, you know, the final chapter, or having a false Jason, right? Eventually they just threw up their hands and say, all right, we're going to make another one, but you got to bring Jason back to life. I mean, this ain't working. So to me, you know, the Friday the 13th series is kind of very different experiences until the true pop culture version of Jason emerges with my favorite and the best one, part 6, Jason Lives. So, you know, everybody has their favorite and they like, oh, the original didn't have Jason in it. Yeah, that's why it's not as good. It's okay. I understand what it is. But you want a pure audience film like a slasher movie? What is better to see in a packed theater than a comedy or a slasher movie, right? I mean, yelling out at the screen is part of the experience. And even part 6 has this scene where there's an American Express card floating on a puddle for probably 8 or 9 seconds because they wanted to make sure that everybody in the theater yelled out, don't leave home without it, right? So that's the other thing. They're awesome audience movies. And part 6, probably going on a tangent here, but part 6 is probably the best audience movie into the peak of the franchise. And when you think of Jason, undead, unstoppable, bulletproof, has the machete, all that stuff, that's part 6. That's where it happened. And that's the version of the character that kind of remained and stamped itself as Jason in popular culture. You don't have Baghead Jason or Young Jason or even the human with a hockey mask. It's clearly a bald head human under there, Jason. We like the undead Jason.
Yeah.
And that's Jason Lives.
Yeah, I like that. That other aspect of the slasher being essentially a cinematic genre is it is a really communal thing. Like it's, you know, if something's not right about watching a slasher by yourself, or maybe something's not right about you if you watch slashers by yourself, but when you're in a room full of people or in a packed theater, that seems about right. And there's something that harkens back to some of those original, like really old rites or, you know, some of the, I don't know, the drama in the BCs that it's either like comedy and satire or it's some sort of terrible tragedy. So something about this, like we all love to laugh at something and be freaked out by something simultaneously together as a community. Yeah. I don't
know. And survive something. We walk out as survivors. We walk out more knowledgeable than the victims. And the other part of the audience experience, you know, Ebert used to call movies like this bruised forearm movies because your date would grab your arm and squeeze it during all the scary parts, right? So even if it's just, this is the time of year for it. You watch a slasher movie with, you know, your date, your wife, your girlfriend, and they're sitting there freaked out. And it's part of, let me show you that I, you know, the male archetype, I'm not scared. I'm a protector. Squeeze my arm and I will laugh at the murders while you shriek and can't look at the screen, right? So that again goes into the audience aspect of these films.
Yeah, man. So we're already about 40 minutes in. I can't believe this. So maybe we could just jump. Could we jump through some of what you think are some of the peaks and valleys? Like where was the slasher done fantastically, and then where did it just bomb out entirely? What are some of those?
The thing about, you know, if you go through the Shudder library and any, to me, it's very hard to find a really great horror movie, let alone a really great slasher movie, right? And you got to take time and everything else into context. You know, as an aside, a friend of mine watched Escape from New York the first time. I was like, oh, the special effects sucked. I was like, that's because it was East St. Louis. You know, Carpenter was bootstrapping that. You have to understand the context, right? So, and if we are going long, I'm more than – you can do this in two parts if there's anything else to talk about or anything like that. Certainly happy to do that. But this is what I like. You know, we talked about the foundations, and I don't love Black Christmas, and I don't love Friday the 13th. Part 1, or really love Part 2, and I don't really love the original Nightmare on Elm Street, even though I think it's maybe the best made one, right? I think when you're looking at the peak of this subgenre, you have to go into some of the sequels or some of the maybe even the lesser known ones. But you know, I just mentioned Friday the 13th Part 6, Jason Lives. Jason is reanimated. He's unstoppable. The kill count is huge. The cast is likable. He's got his own Dr. Loomis slash adversary slash hype man, Tommy Jarvis, who is an adult now. And he's played by Tom Matthews, who was in Return of the Living Dead. So he's just very, I don't know, innocent and energetic. And it's one of the few movies, probably maybe the only movie, the camp is packed with kids. I mean, the peril. You have the counselors that you like. You have the kids there. And then you have an undead, animated, Frankenstein-like, unstoppable killer. And he is knocking off people in creative ways every 10 minutes with all of these audience cues, all of this fun going on. You love the sheriff in his smart mouth. He's very Tom Atkins-y, even though it's not played by Tom Atkins. And the other thing, I think it's the first one that started winking at the audience a little bit. It wasn't meta for the sake of being meta, right? But you have those little, these little hints where the fourth wall is maybe cracking a little bit. It kind of knows we're six movies in. You're in on this where the caretaker goes, oh, why'd they have to go and dig up Jason again? And kind of glances at the screen, right? You have kind of that. So that to me is like the pinnacle of the franchise, and it kind of all went kind of downhill from there. And it really used the foundations laid by the early movies to say, okay, we've got this mythology. Let's blow it out the box. So that to me is a peak. Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, The Dream Warriors is a peak. You've taken this lush landscape of the dream where Wes Craven can have the most surreal and creative kills. And he does that in Nightmare on Elm Street and to some extent in Part 2. Part 3 brings the final girl back from the first one. So you have this returning hero. Again, you have an Ahab hype man in Save the Cat, the half man, the person who knows the monster, who has battled it before, who can tell them what they're up against. Yeah. And instead of unsuspecting victims being offed one by one, these kids are in a psych ward. They know Freddy's coming in their dreams, and they start to believe they can control their own dreams. And then you have this inception-y, let's do a co-dream, all we're all in the same one. So instead of Freddy stalking and killing people, you have, for example, the nerd who you love and you don't want to see him die, which is rare. He's in a wheelchair. He's in a psych ward. He wants to be a wizard. And you have this scene where Freddy stalks him and he realizes, oh, I control my own dreams. I'm a wizard. Boom. Lightning coming out of his hands. Freddy's on the – I mean just like on the ropes. And there's so many scenes like that where you're like, damn, this is – they're fighting back. They know what they're up against. And when he keeps overcoming it with a great one-liner and a brutal kill – it just makes it the peak of the Nightmare on Elm Street experience, right?
Yeah.
And some of those are pretty obvious. I think the peak Halloween movie is probably the first one. I don't think you can definitely – you can't really match that. And another overlooked one that I put on my peaks list is – and people have to dig deep to find this one – The Burning.
Yeah, I don't know The Burning. You mentioned that, but I don't know this one.
The Burning is a – it's the movie that started Miramax. Bob and Harvey Weinstein, The Legend of Cropsey. And they decided we're going to do the Cropsey legend. We're going to do it at a summer camp. Jason Alexander is in it and looks like George from Seinfeld and acts like George from Seinfeld all the way back in like 1980. And here's what's crazy about it. It was kind of free of the influence – of the slasher movies like Friday the 13th. I think it predated Friday the 13th. And so it kind of played by its own rules. So you have this very patient, kind of well-done Weinstein slasher movie with these chatty, funny side characters. And what's great is there's so many of them. You're like, they're not all going to die, are they? And you don't know who dies. The kills are a huge surprise. Tom Savini was disillusioned with Friday the 13th and jumped over to power the gore of this movie, right?
He can do it if anybody can.
Right, yeah. And you don't get multi-kills too often in a slasher. You know, you get the couple, you know, having sex. You can do a two-for-one, but this one has a raft scene that is just amazing. And the ending kind of, if you look at it now, you're like, whoa, it kind of plays against final girl conventions. But in this one, there was no final girl conventions. It didn't know any better. So the ending is very unique to the slasher genre. So it's just kind of like, man, that's one of those from this era that's really well done. And in that one being really well done, It actually ruined another one called Madman that is on a lot of people's cult classic list. I would put that one in the valleys or shitty box. Watch it because it's so bad it's good kind of a movie. And the reason is they found out, oh my God, there's another Cropsey movie coming out. So we got to change ours all around and make it Madman Mars, this mutated farmer, you know, and it becomes this cult classic movie that people watch because it's crappy. But I think there's better choices for that for pure entertainment. And, you know, that's my next little batch that I kind of set to the side. I kind of call them valleys, kind of slasher movies that are poorly made, sometimes on purpose, sometimes on accident, I think mostly by accident. But they kind of just stumble into these iconic moments and become these movies. You're like, you gotta see this. If you've never seen it, you gotta see it, right? So Pieces is one of those. I love the tagline. It is what you think it is, right?
Pieces.
Pieces. So you have a kid in the prologue. You just have just like your young Michael Myers ripoff kid doing a jigsaw puzzle. Gets disciplined, and then you start to put together there's this slasher killer out there taking the parts of women to put together a woman, and it's very much a slasher movie. You know, you have your kills at certain intervals, but there's these incredible continuity errors, there's these random moments, there's this bad acting that's hilarious, there is a kung fu scene where they just get like aggressively attacked by a kung fu fighter who then comes to his senses and says, I must have had some bad chop suey, and walks away. Unresolved plot point, right? And the ending is just, I don't know. It was almost like you're sitting around, what would be the craziest, most nonsensical thing we could do? Well, let's do that. So that's one of those so bad it's good picks for you. I put Sleepaway Camp in that one too. A lot of people know the plot twist of that one. But and you look at it, it's kind of generally well done. It tries to give some pathos and everything. But it's just kind of a hot mess the entire way through until you get this final shot that has made the movie a cult classic and famous, and they tried to spawn a series off of it that just didn't work once you had this twist that you've used up. And trust me, there's no shortage of so bad it's good kind of slasher movies out there. The great majority of them are bad and poorly paced and poorly acted and poorly made. The reason being, what have I said repeatedly? They're cheap, easy, and profitable to make, and the 80s is just peppered with them. So to me, it just makes the big boys stand out even more because they had some budget, they had some mythology, you know, they had some, they had fans, you know, they're anti-heroes at that point.
Yeah, and I'm curious what you think about, because you'd brought up some of these that are meta. And so my mind's going a couple places for those like slasher films that they get this trope that has been established through the late 70s and all through the 80s and early 90s. They get all the tropes and yet they still want to make a slasher film, but they also want to be aware that they get it and that they know the audience gets it. And so slightly more not that recent anymore, but one tried to do comedy before it got real into its own version of the slasher, which was a like Behind the Mask, something about Leslie Vernon, and that was surprisingly good, but really that came after Scream. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are, like, where does Scream fall for you?
So Scream, I think I have in my peaks, right? Because Scream kind of revived the slasher after it kind of just, you know, okay, VHS is kind of done. We're kind of burned out on these. Wes Craven comes back and revives the genre again. And I think 1996 with Scream. But this time, the characters knew all the rules, right? So to me, it's really not, I mean, to me, it's not the definition of like meta. It's just a more knowledgeable cast that makes you as an audience member more vulnerable. You used to empower yourself as an audience member because you knew more than them. You knew where the killer was. Yeah. You knew you shouldn't go in there. You knew not to say, I'll be right back. But now they know it too. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm with them. Right? And if you watch it, oh, it's meta, meta, meta. No, it's not. It kind of just is a slasher movie with brutal, fast knife kills, very brutal murders. It's very grounded. It has a very logical reason for the killer seeming to be in two places at once, right? Which we see in a lot of these movies.
Yeah.
It has a little, you know, the mask serves as mystery, serves as fear, but it's very standard. There's a body count. It's every 10 minutes someone's dying. And it just, that little meta piece kind of just adds an element to it, right? Because I don't like the pure meta slasher that's like, we don't know how to make a horror movie, so let's just make fun of horror movies. It's, you can't play it for comedy, for pure comedy, and like call it a slasher movie. Now, I think Leslie Vernon stands apart, right? And the reason being, think of the last 30 minutes of that movie. It was a creative way to get your guard down and unleash a really unique and creative slasher third act with a different type of context and a different type of stakes.
Yeah, I so wasn't I think, ready for it. I'm kind of ruining it for anybody who hasn't enjoyed it. But I thought it was just like, you know, the Christopher Guest version of a horror movie. Like it was a cute, like mockumentary for a while. I was not ready for it to, in the third act, turn full on scary slasher movie. And it's good. It's really good.
So, and that brings me to my next point. I think if you want to make the new modern slasher and you see some of this, you've either got to go back to your roots and just make a good one like they're trying to do with the Victor Crowley type movies. But we are so burned out on that. Then your other avenue is let's make it funny or meta or add these crazy twists to it, like Ruin Me on Shudder, which I did not like. The Furies is interesting, but it's basically Hunger Games with slashers. You know, you're kind of missing the point there. You can't just make a comedy. You know, Tucker and Dale versus Evil is not a slasher. It's a comedic love letter to the subgenre,
yeah.
But it's not a slasher. Leslie Vernon is a really creative way to take the subgenre as the foundation and build something surprising on top of it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the move now. And that's why, you know, my own, you know, if you're like, Freddie, you're in all these slashers, why are you watching all these? My own personal idea, the only way I can really pitch it is, and this is not meant to be meta, it's meant to be grounded. Imagine Halloween as an 8-hour Netflix series called Haddonfield. Why are people still in these places? He comes back every few years. He's obviously supernatural. He murders you while you're at your kitchen sink. You know this has happened 5, 6, 7 times. Why are you still in Haddonfield? What is it like between the murders? What type of person moves there intentionally, right? Bring the humanity to the horror. And what type of plan do they have for the slasher? How can a slasher meet his match if a town is ready, with almost treating him as an active shooter and having these plans and saying, okay, well, you can't kill him, so it'll be like a shark. We'll just mark him and we'll go to these safe places and we'll get bust out of the town and all this other stuff. So I'm really playing with the subgenre as a foundation for, you know, a horror novel that I'm envisioning as a prestige TV series. And I think that is nowadays how you're going to do something new with the subgenre if you're not just retreading it as and going for nostalgia. So you have like Victor Crowley is going for nostalgia, and Leslie Vernon is building something unique, creative, and very good on top of it, whereas Tucker and Dale versus Evil or Ruin Me is missing the point entirely. So that's my take on the future of it.
Yeah, well, that your vision of like the Netflix series Haddonfield, where it's taking that seriously and building off of that, that's solid gold, man. I'll buy that for a dollar.
Well, yeah, I was out in L.A. and I just they're like, what are you working on? I was like, well, I'm rewriting a book, but then I got 25,000 words into this, and I call it He Returns. You know, just a classic slasher type title. And, yeah, the eyebrows are arching up. Maybe when you're done with that, maybe send it to me or just give me a 1-page synopsis of that. You know, you can definitely kind of see it there. So, that's what I'm playing with. That's going to be my Fred Venturini take on, the classic slasher to really focus on the town. And, you know, I think one of the more interesting things you can do, in movies in general is something that, you know, I can go for with material like this is when you finally have that monster in the cage, right? That Hannibal Lecter's in the cage or Jason Voorhees, you've trapped him in a cage, yeah. Or that evil prisoner, you trapped him in a cage. When things get so bad, the hero has to say, I'm going to let you out.
Yeah.
Right. And then you go from almost, you have these elements of who's worse, Jason Voorhees or the people that he's killing in this town, who's worse, the citizens in, of Haddonfield who have remained, or Michael Myers? And then I start to get into the thought, hey, this really plays into the themes of normalization, right? We're in the Trump era. We've normalized certain types of tweets and behavior. What is it like if you were just, you know, I almost have this short film vision of you're walking down the streets of Manhattan and Jason Voorhees is slashing people and you're just walking over the bodies because you know that's it's like rain. He just shows up every once in a while and there's nothing you can do. And why are people staying in these rural towns? Are you trapped in Haddonfield because you can't afford to go anywhere else? You don't have the means, you don't have the skills, you don't have the talents. You're just trapped in Haddonfield saying, you know what? There's only like a 1 in 900 chance that he kills me next time. I'll take those chances. Land is cheap.
Yeah. I mean, I really like that idea. I mean, I think I kind of play with it a little bit in my fiction here and there, this idea of like opening the door and letting the monster out to, you know, when the tyranny has gone far enough, it's time to welcome back the chaos. But, you know, well, that kind of takes us back to the angel of death in Egypt, right? When the civilization becomes too corrupt and too tyrannical, it's time for chaos and death incarnate to walk door to door and start breaking it up and breaking up the ice of that thing and letting the blood flow like the Nile that turns to blood itself. So I don't know, man.
See, that's why I call you the horror scientist, right? Like I'm in here and my stuff stops at like 1974 on this and you've got me thinking biblical on it. Right. And I love that idea because, you know, as you know from another one of my book ideas, basically I take small towns and I want to destroy them by the end. It's this thought of cleansing. And sometimes it's very interesting to cleanse with a dark force, you know, and really that one or two people who are left alive at the end of it, well, maybe they deserve to be alive or maybe they don't. I just, you know, you play with those themes. But to me, an idea like that is not meta. It's grounded. Yeah. And to me, there's a difference. Pure meta stuff to me is breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience. And they don't do that in Scream. And they don't do that in Jason Lives. And I don't intend to do that. But when you have so much nudge, nudge, wink, wink going on, like Cabin in the Woods, I have a really weird relationship with that movie. Because I understand, once again, that's one of those, I think it's a love letter, but I don't necessarily think it's a slasher. I think it knows what a slasher is, and it's kind of raising its glass to it. But it's too meta for me to kind of say, you're getting gritty with it. And this is a slasher movie, right? So yeah. I have a complex relationship with that one.
Well, I tell you what, when you're like Key Returns or your version of Haddonfield finally hits it big and is released on Netflix, at least people will know they heard it here first on The Monster Professor. They knew it was coming and going to be a big hit.
Oh, yeah. I think so, well, if you're out there, just try and steal the idea. I'm almost done, but just like Bob Clark said something and John Carpenter made Halloween, if you want to go out there and make Haddonfield or do something different with it, you know me. I always think every artist has a different story to tell and no two stories are the same. So that's why I am speaking freely about this exciting slasher idea, which will give me another excuse to come on here and talk about slashers in a couple of years probably. But yeah. Every time Halloween or something rolls around and you want to chat about this stuff, the memories aren't going anywhere.
Well, man, this has been an awesome conversation. I really appreciate it. And so maybe we can wind up with people hearing about you for the first time. Where should they go to find out more? Say they want a copy of your newest book, Escape of Light, or they want to find out more about what you're up to. Is there a newsletter? Where should we send them to find out more about Fred Venturini?
Man, you know, first and foremost, you can always, I have a very unique name. You can just Google the name. Right? Fred Venturini on Twitter, Fred Venturini on Facebook. I got a Facebook page. But really, you know, fred@fredventurini.com. If you want to email me about slashers or you want anything else, just to talk shop, talk about the books, anything like that, I make myself available. I am not so big that I do not respond to everybody. So it might take a couple of days, but I do get to everybody who emails me about anything interesting. And I kind of do have a little weekly newsletter, but it's kind of closed. There's no place to really sign up for it right now. I do a 2-1-1 email on Thursdays, two quotes, one thought, one question, kind of a funnily enough, it's kind of a crazy philosophical self-improvement type email based on things that I'm thinking about and things that I'm reading. And, but I would say if you're going to pick anything out there, go search my name on Amazon, pick up one of the books. There's actually A Pound of Flesh is on there for, I think, 99 cents. It's a good introduction to the dark stuff that I do. It is a long short story or a short novella, whatever you want to call it. And it's my take on a home invasion story. And I know that one has freaked some people out in the past, but Escape of Light is on there too. And if you want to go light side, dark side, 99 cents on one side, grab the book on the other side. I'd be more than happy to talk to anyone about it.
Awesome, man. Well, check out that stuff if you like anything that you heard so far. Awesome books. Escape of Light's fantastic, man. It takes what, you know, has been kind of this young adult genre, and it brings it into a real space. And so I think we're just weeks away from that becoming a national hit. I hope I didn't jinx you.
I hope
I blessed you on that one.
If you're jinxing, I'll reverse jinx it right back, and we'll be something good will happen, I hope so.
And this has been an awesome conversation about slashes, man. So thank you so much for coming on the Monster Professor.
All right. Hey, it was a blast. Let's do it again sometime.